To the left-hand side for Vieira, who'll play it through to Gabriel Jesus, who's in here for Arsenal. Gabriel Jesus to finish it off. Oh, what a way to do it! Gabriel Jesus seals the points for Arsenal. He's back, and he's back with a bang.
Into the penalty area it goes. Gabriel header, and it's into the back of the net. Arsenal take an early lead through Gabriel.
You're listening to the Chronicles of Aguna, the daily Arsenal podcast with me, Harry Simeon.
Hey everybody, how's it going? Welcome back along to the Chronicles of Aguna, the Arsenal podcast, part of the 90 Min Football family with me, your host, Harry Simeon. On this edition, we're going to be discussing Arsenal's defensive structure. How has Mikel Arteta created this defensive monster that has only conceded 2 goals in their last 7 Premier League away games? And if you look at the 2 goals that we've conceded, you're talking about a David Raya pass straight to Christian Romero and a penalty. This team defensively are really, really special. They're not bad offensively either, but we're going to focus on why it is that Arsenal have been able to keep people at bay so often. What is it that Mikel Arteta's done to give us this defensive platform that we're waxing lyrical about now on a regular basis? We're also going to reflect a little bit more on the North London derby, because some of the noise around Michael Oliver in the sort of aftermath of this game is driving me absolutely insane. We're also going to talk about the Premier League's proposed spending cap, where the clubs have voted for that idea to be further developed. We're also going to take some of your questions from the live chat, and we'll probably talk a little bit of Charlie Patino as well, because he has been in the papers this morning. Hope you're all good. Hope you're all well. Let me say a few hellos to some of you joining us in the live chat. We've got Afsar. I hope you're well, my friend. We've got Matt joining us from Chicago. Good to see you. Creambone, one of our admins. He says, afternoon, young Harold. Trust you're well. Been a minute, but don't worry. I've been stalking you and your fantastic content. For your information, that was still done. Raya, not Saliba. Trev, good to see you in the chat, mate. It's been a while. Evan is with us as well. Hope you are good. Robbie joins us and says, Harry and co, morning from the Intermountain West. Trust life is gaining back some normalcy, Harry. Hoping to catch more of your live efforts. Have said it before, we'll say it again. You've made the last 2 to 3 years so enjoyable. Keep it up, up the Gunners. Thank you so, so much, mate. It really means the world to me to know that people are firstly listening and tuning into the content, and secondly, really, really enjoying it. And as I kind of teased you with the other day, I've got some big news coming up about the podcast, which is going to take it up to another level. And I'm really, really, really excited about it. I'll do an explainer video when the time is right for me to announce it. But I'm really, really looking forward to what the future holds. There's going to be more content. There's going to be a more regular calendar, which I know a lot of people have been calling for, but some things have kind of fallen into place that have allowed me to do this. And I know I've said this before, but I genuinely mean it this time. There is not going to be any sort of scaling it back, dialing it back. None of that is going to happen, because quite simply, it has to work. Also, on top of that, I know a lot of people have asked questions about members' content and things like that over the last few months, where it has been really inconsistent. And I know that that is not good enough, and I know that that is on me. So what I'm going to do is, throughout the entire summer, for the end of the season and throughout the entire summer, we're going to make a load of members' content, but it's going to go out for free. You'll be able to sign up for free and get access to this members' content. And over the course of the summer, you can decide whether you like it or not and whether it is worth becoming a member for. So that is coming as well. Loads and loads to come. I've got somebody coming in behind the scenes to help me organize all that technical stuff and all that, technical stuff, I guess, is what it is that I'm really, really bad at, and put a calendar in place that I have to stick to. And as I say, because some other bits and pieces are falling into place for me ahead of the new season, that means that I can do this and I can stick to this. And I'm really, really super excited about that. Okay. What else have we got in the live chat? We've got James. We've got Guna73. Harry is with us as well. Great name. We've also got some comments coming in from John, from Zed Tom, from Bad Boy. We've got Jid in the chat as well. Fizzy, Abdi is with us. Earfan is with us. We've got Dr. Pepper, who says, a later start today. Good to join you live, Harry, watching from Western Australia. Finally relaxed after that stressful game. My God, it was stressful, wasn't it? We've also got Temi, and we've got Clock In Seb as well, who says, I remember the days when we'd spend an hour working out how to upgrade Mustafi. Times have really, really changed, haven't they? If I could just ask you before we dive into the main subject of today's podcast, which is Arsenal's defensive structure, that you just leave a like on the video, that you subscribe to the channel as well. That really, really does help. Thank you so much. I love this from Temi. I'm talking about why Arsenal's defense is so good, what is so brilliant about it. Temi Ola says, we win our duels. Yep. It is sometimes just as simple as that. But we're going to get into the tactical side of it right after this. So why is Mikel Arteta's defense so bloody good these days? What is it that Mikel Arteta has done? What is it that he's changed? What is it that he's tweaked to put Arsenal in a position where defensively they're as solid as they've been, I would argue, since the Invincibles? Maybe even more defensively solid than the Invincibles were. And that's a big statement when you're talking about a side that never lost the game. Let's go into the tactical side of things. And I want to share with you guys the tactics board. You know how much I love the tactics board. And I want to focus on some examples from the Tottenham Hotspur game that we saw, of course, take place this weekend. So on paper, it looked like Tottenham played with a kind of 4-2-1-3. So the back four, then they had the two kind of holding midfielders with James Maddison playing in front of them, having that little bit more license and freedom to get up alongside Heung-min Son, who led the attack. And they had Timo Werner, or they started with Timo Werner and Dejan Kulusevski either side of the centre forward. Now, Arsenal's team on paper very much looked like a back four with Thomas Partey sitting just in front of it, Rice and Odegaard playing as kind of eights, with Trossard and Saka wide attackers either side of Kai Havertz, who was the centre forward. And what I'm going to demonstrate on this edition of the podcast is the difference in the shapes that Arsenal take up when they're A, in possession, and B, without possession. That's where the key is. That's what Mikel Arteta has been able to implement, which has made the world of difference. It's not just about your initial starting system and formation. It's about understanding when the trigger points are to shapeshift into something different and to put yourself in a position where defensively you are a lot more sturdy and a lot more sound. So we'll get into that now. In possession, this is the way that Arsenal like to play. They like to push Leandro Trossard and Bukayo Saka right up. They use Kai Havertz as the centre forward at the moment. And they like to try and get Declan Rice and Martin Odegaard into these half space positions. And it puts Arsenal in a position where essentially at times in a game, they're attacking with a front five. Now, we've highlighted that on many occasions over the course of the season. Put Thomas Partey into the midfield. Tomiyasu, Gabriel and Saliba, along with White, would like to play a high line. And the space between the back line and the forward line of five when Arsenal are in possession is as minimal as it possibly can be. And the reason Arsenal have been able to do that this season is because if somebody drops a ball over the top of Arsenal's back line, they trust in Gabriel and Saliba in particular's ability to win a foot race, win an aerial duel, as Mikel Arteta would say, and stop the opposition getting into a dangerous position. If you don't go long, then with this front five and Partey following that up and Gabriel and Saliba pushing right up to the halfway line and Tomiyasu getting involved and Ben White getting involved as well, Arsenal will just suffocate the life out of you. What Arsenal like to do, both in possession and out of possession, is make the pitch as small as possible. Now, you can't physically reduce the size of a football pitch, so it does mean that you leave big spaces in behind you. But if you trust in your ability to deal with direct balls over the top, and you've got a goalkeeper who's very front-footed, like David Raya, who's quite happy to take up a high position in order to sweep up where necessary, then you can do that. You can compact the pitch into a much smaller area where the action is, and you can do that if you're all on the same page. Do not underestimate how unbelievably well-drilled you need to be to carry this out. This is not something that you can do unless every single player understands the system inside out. And the more you do something, the more it becomes habit, the more it becomes second nature, and the less you need to think about it. But this is Arsenal in possession. What do Arsenal do that's so effective out of position? Well, the shape out of possession is completely different. If you go back and watch the Spurs game again, one of the issues that Tottenham Hotspur had was that we made the central areas of the pitch so compact that we constantly forced them out wide, and we trusted in our ability as a defense to deal with those crosses. And the fact that they didn't really have an out and out center forward, I think, benefited us. Became a bit more of an issue when Richarlison came on, who gave them a bit of an aerial threat. But what we did was we compacted the pitch in the central areas, and we adjusted and morphed our shape into a much more narrow 4-4-2. Yes, 4-4-2. You know that system that Sam Allardyce used to play, the one that everybody says is out of date? Well, that's the system and the shape that Arsenal take up when they're out of possession these days. Odegaard and Havertz will play like a front two. They will go and press. They will go and try and make things difficult for people. And when you do win the ball back, you've got a big man up top in Kai Havertz that you can hit nice and early should you choose not to try and play through the lines. And you've got somebody up there alongside him who can go close to him, try and get in and around him and win that second ball should you try and take that more direct approach. But this 4-4-2 system that Arsenal morph into when they're out of possession right now is so incredibly effective. It's two banks of four. It's narrow. It's a little bit old school. But in terms of making us defensively compact, it really, really does work. And Mikel Arteta's side have nailed this down to a T. We started to see glimpses of it a little bit earlier on in the season, I would argue. We saw it when Jorginho came into the team alongside Declan Rice when we beat Liverpool at Emirates Stadium. That was a good example of it that day. Same thing, Havertz and Odegaard or whoever was playing up top, and Odegaard were in those areas trying to be aggressive on the press. And so we seem to have found a really good balance between leaving enough bodies up the pitch to be able to press and to be able to go direct from deep, but also making sure that we have those two compact banks of four and being able to limit our opposition. Now, when you do this, it means it's quite difficult sometimes to break out with any real pace and speed. And there are times where we have to go a little bit more direct as a result of that to get out of situations. And in a game like Spurs away, that's why Kai Havertz was perfectly suited. You play with Gabriel Jesus up front. As much as he's got his own qualities, he isn't going to give you that same option of going long. And at times, you'll even see Martin Odegaard drop that little bit deeper, and it becomes a 4-4-1-1 with Kai Havertz being the sole front man, Martin Odegaard dropping into the midfield, trying to get onto whoever the defensive midfield player or low sitting midfield player is for the opposition, and stopping them being a dictator from deep in midfield. Now, what this does is it means that the space centrally is super limited. Now, that does mean, you know, because you can't cover the entire width of the pitch, that you do leave corridors of space in positions like this. But if you force them wide of the width of the penalty area, then you will back your team's ability to win their aerial duels. And with Gabriel and Saliba at the back, that is far easier, with Declan Rice and Thomas Partey sitting in front of them. And if you look back at that Spurs game, and I watched it back, the amount of times that Saka and Trossard were back defending like fullbacks was incredible. There were even times, guys, where Tottenham were pushing extra bodies forward, because whatever you say about Ange Postecoglou and Tottenham Hotspur and some of their shortcomings, they are a brave side. They will try to commit bodies forward. And when they did that at times, you actually saw Leandro Trossard tuck in as a left back and Tomiyasu tuck inside. And at points, you also saw that on the other side where Saka would tuck in at right back and the defense would shift across. So there were points where we had a back five. Odegaard would then drop into the midfield, and you had a five and a four. That was Arsenal defending really, really, really effectively, guys. And It's about the shape. It's about forcing people wide into areas that you feel much more comfortable in defending. It's about having small gaps between people so there isn't any space in between the lines, which is where teams often hurt you. But it's also about having great fucking players. It's also about having a love for defending. And it's also about the physical dominance that this team has over most people that they come up against. And the ability to shapeshift between this really aggressive front-footed five-pronged attack and then drop into sometimes two banks of four, sometimes a bank of four and a bank of five, sometimes a bank of five at the back and four across the midfield, and do it like clockwork and understand what the trigger points are that require you to morph into that different shape is a testament to how well this team is coached. It really, really is impressive. And I'm really, really enjoying watching it. And where I was at Spurs the other day, and I was up in the gantry, it's quite high up, and I got to watch this from distance unfold. And then when I watched it back on TV, it confirmed the notes that I made in my little notebook whilst watching the game on Sunday. So I think that's the key. I think Mikel Arteta's realization that in this league, you need to be more than just one-dimensional. You need to be more than just a one-trick pony. You need to be a side that can adapt according to the opposition, that can adapt according to the circumstances, and that can shapeshift from when they have the ball to not having the ball at the drop of a hat, to the point where you lose possession, but you're confident everybody's going to get back into those defensive positions ASAP. And it takes a really, really good side to expose that really short window of time in which you're making this shift. That's the key to Arsenal's defensive solidity of late. It's the ability to change between two shapes and execute it to perfection. Every single one of those players, as I say, has to understand the trigger points, has to understand where they need to be, and has to understand the distances that they need to keep from their teammates in terms of or the distances they need to keep in relation to their teammates in order to protect certain corridors, protect certain channels, and force teams into areas where they're unlikely to do as much damage. Unlikely to do as much damage. This is the Diego Simeone way of defending. That's the similarity. That's the, when I think about who else does this, when I think about who the guy is that's maybe laid the blueprint in recent years for solid defenses, it probably is Diego Simeone. I'd argue that in the last few years, that's changed a little bit. The way that Atleti play has changed a little bit. I just think that Diego Simeone, his sides were incredibly difficult to break down. They would do it with the two banks of four. I heard him speaking in a kind of coaching lecture once, and he talked about the fact that you need to protect the width of the box first and foremost. And he was so passionate about that. You know, I think he made the point of how many times does a player pick up the ball from outside the width of the penalty area and beat a goalkeeper without the ball coming infield at any point? How often does that happen? You're playing a bit of a numbers game. And so if you can reduce people's chances of getting into shooting positions from which they're likely to cause you a problem, then of course, in theory, you're going to keep the ball out of the back of your net a lot more. So those are my thoughts on why Arsenal I've been so defensively solid of late. Let me know your thoughts and give me your questions in the live chat box as well. We'll be back after a really short pause. We've still got to talk about the North London Derby and the crying from down the road. We're also going to talk about the spending cap and we're going to take more of your questions between now and 3 p.m. Get them in and I'll be back with you in just a sec. Okay, welcome back to the Chronicles of a Gooner. Let's have a look. Creambone says, so in your opinion, where do you think Arteta will want to strengthen next season, given your analysis of our defensive structure? See, I don't think with Julian Timber coming back that the defence is a real priority. I think the only way, I beg your pardon, that you can package up the defence as maybe being a priority is if you say that you're concerned about some of the players' injury records. For example, Takahiro Tomiyasu. when he's fit and he's available, he's a massive asset to this team because he can play left back, right back, centre back. Not a problem. You know, you look at Ben White, he's pretty robust. So are Gabriel and Saliba, which is great. But then Jurrien Timber's coming back from a long-term injury. In and among all the excitement after the North London derby on Sunday, I think it went under the radar a little bit, actually, that Jurrien Timber played another 70 minutes for the under-21s. So he is on his way back to peak condition, on his way back to full fitness. And I don't know this for a fact, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if he was named in the squad to face Bournemouth this weekend in the Premier League. We'll have to wait and see. I think we do need to strengthen in the attacking areas. I think that maybe, just maybe, the emergence of Kai Havertz as a really useful centre-forward option might lead to Mikel Arteta prioritising a wide forward. I don't know. It's just a feeling that I have at the moment. But I certainly think we need to strengthen in midfield. Because when we have Rice and Partey and we have that physical dominance and power, it makes the world of difference. Jorginho's good in his own right. And I'd still give Jorginho a short contract extension, by the way, because I think he's worthy of it. And I think he brings a lot to not just on the pitch, but behind the scenes as well. But I would look for a dominant, powerful centre midfielder that can just kind of complete the set for us, given that Thomas Partey is another player that we're worried about when it comes to fitness issues and injury. So those are the areas that I would look at. What else have we got? Jid says, I called the analysis. I can't see what the emojis are because I don't have them. Because they don't come through on StreamYard. One second, let me check them on. But two banks of four is almost a standard for a lot of teams. It was a standard. Two banks of four was a standard thing for a lot of teams. And, you know, you used to see it really, really often. I still think you do see it, but you see variations of it. And I think that because we focus a lot on the formations that teams take up when in possession or the way that they're displayed on paper, you can ignore the fact that actually this is a really effective way of nullifying an opponent and limiting spaces in those central areas. I think we've been doing it for a little while. But just watching the Spurs game back, a game where we didn't have a lot of possession in the first half. We were pinned back at points by Tottenham Hotspur, even though that didn't really amount to the sort of attempts on goal and saves that David Raya had to make. Territorially, they were quite dominant. And that gave us an opportunity to watch Arsenal against a side where they're not dominating the ball, which isn't often the way, and really study and focus on that shape. But it's interesting that Mikel Arteta, who's always hailed as this really forward-thinking modern-day coach, and of course he is that, is also quite willing to look back at things that have worked in the past for other managers and utilize those particular methods in order to prevent his side from leaking goals. It is brilliant. It's brilliant. It really is. Because you can be a snob nowadays and go, 4-4-2, that's so 1995, mate. I'm not doing that anymore. But actually, if that's what works for you, then why not? Why not be adaptable? Why not be open to the idea of changing things up a little bit? Hacker says, it's a shame you couldn't get some barbecue talking with Ange, but it would have been interesting. Mate, Ange didn't even look at anyone in the room, so I'm certain that if I'd brought up the topic of barbecues, he would have snubbed me. John Daly says, I'd love to know your feelings on this, Harry. Do you believe that Spurs not getting the top four this season could be worse than people are thinking? Chelsea, United, Villa and Newcastle all have more pull. I've said for a long time that I can't understand why Ange Postecoglou insists on dismissing the impact that Champions League qualification would have on his side. Because even if you take all of that stuff out, you know, the pool stuff, the, you know, how attractive they are to, you know, prospective players and things like that. Just knowing what we know about Daniel Levy and the way that he's quite averse to spending vast amounts of money, you just feel like an extra 60, 75 million quid, whatever it would be that a Champions League campaign would bring, particularly with the extra games now, you just feel like that would really boost Tottenham Hotspur and boost Ange Postecoglou's transfer kitty. So I can't understand, you know, maybe he's saying something different in the changing room. In fact, I'm sure he is, but I can't understand why they constantly dismiss the importance of you know, making the Champions League. Maybe they'd argue that they're not quite ready for it as a squad, but the finances you would get would surely help you in equipping that squad to be able to cope with that. And ultimately, that's where Tottenham Hotspur want to be, is it not? That amazing stadium and all the rest of it. What else have we got? The robots will eat you, says. We've seen evolutions in how we set up season to season. What do you think the next change will be and how we play tomorrow? Honestly, mate, I don't know. It's really, really difficult to know what's coming next. And, you know, for the purpose of being competitive, I'm sure Mikel Arteta likes it that way. People having to kind of figure out and suss out maybe what his next move is going to be. In this league, if you stand still, you will get found out. And I honestly do believe that Ange Postecoglou is in that position now where he really needs to change things or at least be a bit more adaptable. And if he's not, this league is going to swallow him up and spit him out. And, you know, you could be talking October, November time next season and saying, you know what? I don't know if he's the right man. And that's the difference. That's what happens when you don't adapt and when you don't, you know, understand that this league is really demanding and that you're going to need to change things up. Harry says, when are you next on TalkSport? I'll be on TalkSport 2 on Friday from 3 till 6 p.m. We'll be building up to all the weekend's action. So you can, join me for that. TalkSport 2, Friday 3 till 6 p.m. You can catch me there every week. As for TalkSport, the other station, whenever I get the call up, I don't know. Sometimes I get a call. You know, at the last minute, depending on what the news is and what the big stories are. Okay, let's take another really short pause. When we come back, we're going to discuss Tottenham Hotspur fans still crying a few days on, and we'll talk about the Premier League's proposed spending cap. We'll be back in just a moment. Let's start off with the Tottenham fans. I mean, I cannot believe how many of them insist that Dejan Kulusevski deserved a penalty kick in that first period. Now, I can understand why there is a desire on the Tottenham fans' part to, you know, want to make a big deal out of that. When you lose, if you can find somebody to blame, it makes it a lot easier, doesn't it? Somebody external, obviously. And I look back at that incident over and over and over again, and I have to really look closely to find that contact. So how can I blame Michael Oliver for not catching that contact in real time? And then even when you watch it back on the replay, the touch from Trossard looks minimal. And as I said on yesterday's show, the fact that that touch is so minimal that Leandro Trossard doesn't even make a challenge means for me that it's not a penalty. And honestly, hand on my heart, I wouldn't be going mad about it if it were the other way around, if it were us on the receiving end of that. I didn't even sit here and cry about the Bukayo Saka against Bayern Munich thing, because I thought that if I was being really honest with myself, that probably wasn't a penalty because Manuel Neuer didn't make a challenge. I'm applying that same principle here. I'm being consistent with this, but you know, I've got one particular friend, Dan DeLuca. You've all seen him on the pod before. He's been going on about this ever since Sunday. Like, he is going to turn up at Michael Oliver's house at this rate. It's really, really worrying. They're just trying to find reasons to blame. Maybe look at your manager. Maybe look at some of your players who just weren't physically competitive enough. Look at the fact that you're terrible at defending from set pieces. I think you've conceded 14 goals from set pieces this season. The fact that you haven't kept a clean sheet at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium in the Premier League for 13 games. These are the real things that Tottenham fans should be looking at in the aftermath of that game. Okay, let's talk about the proposed new plans or the plans that are in development ahead of a potential spending cap coming in the Premier League. So the Premier League clubs have voted in favour of developing the plans to introduce a spending cap. 16 of the Premier League clubs approved the proposals for the Premier League to then go on and complete the final economic and legal analysis required to create a spending cap model. The model may be presented two clubs at June's AGM meeting, and if voted through, it would replace the current profit and sustainability rules from the 25-26 season onwards. Manchester City, Manchester United, and Aston Villa opposed the possible introduction of a spending cap on Monday, while Chelsea abstained from the vote. Everybody else voted in favour of this. Now, the league's current financial rules, under which Everton and Nottingham Forest have both been penalised and lost points this season, have been criticised for favouring clubs with the highest revenue. A spending cap would limit clubs' outlay on transfers, wages and agents' fees, and proposals have reportedly including the spending being anchored to between 4 and 5 times the amount of the lowest earning Premier League club in TV revenue. So, for example, according to this BBC Sport article, Leeds United, who finished 19th in the Premier League in the 22-23 season, they earned £112 million in broadcast revenue. That was the least of the 20 clubs in the top flight. So what we are saying, what this proposal is saying, is that your spending in terms of wages and salaries and you know, transfer spend would be limited to 4 to 5 times that amount. So even the lowest amount of TV revenue, and this is only going to get higher, £112 million, means that you could potentially spend over £500 million. That is a ceiling being put in place, but it's not exactly going to like cut the arms off of some of these clubs that like to spend big money. So I don't really understand the outrage. No coincidence that it's Manchester City, Manchester United and Aston Villa that opposed this introduction. I'm surprised that Chelsea abstained. I guess that was their way of saying we're not in favour of it, but we don't want to go on record as saying no, because we're trying to keep everyone sweet. Because guess what? We're another team that are being looked at and could be in trouble with the current PSR stuff in the not too distant future. Man United need an overhaul and they bring in incredible revenues. You can understand why they don't want this to go through. Manchester City, the less we say about them and finances, the better. Aston Villa surprised me a little bit, but speaking to a couple of Aston Villa fans yesterday, it's pretty clear that their ownership have big ambitions for the football club and are probably in a position where they are looking to invest some big, big money. And this would obviously limit them to what they're able to do. I still think, and I'd still argue that they'd be able to spend more than enough, but that's probably why they are one of the clubs against this. What do we think about it? I'm in favour of it. And from what I've heard today, Kieran Maguire, who's a football finance expert, was on TalkSport and he said that Tim Lewis of Arsenal, along with Steve Parrish of Crystal Palace, are two of the people that have been a real driving force behind this proposal. So Arsenal are clearly well in favour of this and what you know, this would mean for the future of English football. Just a quick chat on Charlie Patino. I'll give you a heads up, get a couple of questions in, and I'll pick up some of those before I disappear at 3 o'clock. But Charlie Patino has been linked with a move to Italy. Roma and Juventus are said to be among the clubs interested in him. Look, I can't see that happening. Like, I've got a lot of friends that are massive Charlie Patino fans that have been waxing lyrical about him for a little while, that think that, you know, he's somebody that Arsenal actually should have kept around the place. I would argue that when he did get obviously very limited opportunities, he didn't really show anything that suggested that he could be a mainstay in this team. I mean, at this moment in time, you bring Sambi Lokonga back in the summer, he goes straight into the pecking order ahead of Charlie Patino because he's been playing in the Premier League all season. Charlie Patino has made 32 appearances in the Championship this season. But, you know, if you look at his minutes since January, right? So if I start from the 20th of January, he played 25 minutes, was an unused sub, 13 minutes, 11 minutes, unused sub. 27 minutes, 11 minutes, 8 minutes, 9 minutes, unused sub, 1 minute, 7 minutes, unused sub again, 7 minutes, unused sub, 16 minutes, unused sub. He's not even cutting it at Swansea. He's not even in the first team as a starter at Swansea. So what makes people think that Charlie Patino has a God-given right to come back into the Arsenal squad and walk straight back into it and start competing for a place? There are people ahead of him. Lokonga, in my opinion, is way ahead of him because he's had a decent season at Luton Town. And I think, you know, I think he's one that we're probably going to move on. But, you know, I'm just making the point that if you're not even above Lokonga in the pecking order, who we were quite happy to loan out for the whole of the season, then what makes you think that you have a future at Arsenal Football Club? The idea that Roma and Juve are coming in for him, that surprises me because, you know, I know that we've seen foreign clubs recently try and pick out players from England at really young ages, because if you do that, you don't have to compete with a Premier League club in terms of going into those negotiations over transfer fees and all the rest of it. But I just don't see either of those two clubs moving for Charlie Patino. I think it'd be a huge, huge risk. If someone's willing to take that risk, if the gamble is worthwhile, if it's low risk, potentially high reward, you might see someone move for him. But Roma or Juve, I personally can't see that happening. Okay, let me take a couple of your questions. And I'll do that right after this very, very short pause. Okay, it's question time on the Chronicles of a Gooner podcast. The robots will eat you, says. Why can't you believe Tottenham fans crying over non-existent penalties? These same man had Kane cheating and being awarded penalties. Match in, match out. It's a good point. It's a good point. Jid says, which club has a deeper squad than Arsenal? Serious question. There's not many when everyone's fit and available that have a deeper squad than Arsenal. I'd argue Man City probably do. But outside of them, then, yeah, you're right. I think Arsenal's squad is a little bit imbalanced still. Like, there's a lot of depth to it. There's a lot of quality in it. I still think it's a little bit imbalanced in that there are certain things that you'd like to have in your armory that maybe we don't, i.e. that out-and-out centre-forward, another specialist right-winger, probably a specialist left-back as well is another position that we could do with maybe adding in the summer. So, yeah, I think there are still things to be done. I don't think you'll ever have the complete squad, but you're right to say that it is one of the better squads in the league. Hacker says Michael Oliver suspended from games this week, it seems, first glance. There's no way that Michael Oliver's been suspended. He might just have a week off. There's no way he's been suspended. He's England's top referee on paper. And he's going to the Euros along with Anthony Taylor, I believe. So there's no way that they're going to mark him down. He didn't get anything wrong at the weekend. So I don't understand why everyone's trying to mark him down or being super critical. The only, and I said it on the reaction show, the only thing, if I were a Spurs fan, I'd be aggrieved about was how he's missed the Rice foul on Davis in real time. Now, obviously, that's what we got VAR for. They stepped in and gave what was the correct decision in the end. But yeah, it's as simple as that for me. When you look back on the game and you think about the collective, the team of officials, the VAR, the assistants, the man in the middle, as a collective, they got all the big decisions in that game right, in my opinion. So what are all the complaints about? I do not know. Guys, if I could just ask you one final time to please leave a like on the video. It really, really does help. There's no reason why we shouldn't have at least 100 likes on the video by the time we finish the live stream, given how many of you are watching. Jabulani says, what do you think of Bruno Guimaraes? Is Kia Jurabshan his agent? I don't actually know who his agent is. I'd have to look it up. But am I a fan of Bruno Guimaraes? Yeah, I think he's a good player. I think he is someone that would fit our midfield quite well. I talked about the need to have physically imposing players in there. And I think he is that. But he's also technically at a really high level, which puts him in the category of your Partey's and your Rice's. I don't think he's as good as either of those two when they're fully fit and sort of sharp and stuff. But he is a good option and he'd fit quite well. I think Douglas Luiz is another one that would fit quite well as well. There's a few players on the continent that people have sort of linked us with. And I'm sure over the course of the summer, we're going to hear loads of those names and we're going to discuss loads of those names. And we're going to, you know, get into all of that over the summer. I just want to focus on the season at the moment. But would I welcome Bruno Guimaraes to Arsenal Football Club? Don't really like him at the minute because of some of the incidents that have been involved. He's been involved in with Arsenal, but I think as a player, he'd be a great asset and a good addition. The problem is that he has this big release clause and I don't know what the landscape's going to look like in the summer because of the PSR stuff. I know it's all being relaxed and it's changing and we're talking about, you know, the proposals and stuff like that, you know, going into the sort of forum now for the spending cap. We don't know where that's going to end up as well, but I'm very wary of getting overexcited in terms of spending the summer. We've made some good money this year because of our Champions League run on top of all the other things as well. But yeah, we'll see. We'll see. Player I'd be interested in, yes, but is that a deal that I think is realistic right now? Probably not. Okay, guys, I am going to leave it there. I've got a meeting at 3 p.m. That I need to dial onto. But thank you all so, so much for joining me. As always, really, really appreciate the support and the love. And we're going to be back with another episode tomorrow. Looking forward to that. I'll see you all then. Until then, take care of yourselves. Make sure you're subscribed. Make sure you're subscribed on audio as well, if that's where you prefer to take in the content. Leave your comments in the comment section below, and I will see you all very soon. Until the next one, take care. Goodbye.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro, easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.